Okay, let's get started. Welcome. Thanks for coming. Does anybody have any questions from Tuesday's session? Any comments, thoughts? Have you analyzed what you heard? And it makes sense, and you have no questions of me. Okay. Getting back to individual projects, these are projects that students are doing for one unit of credit with a letter grade. I still would like to have every student let me know which option you chose, and if you need help in identifying a device, a topic, or somebody to interview. So please send me email specifically about, you know, which topic you're going to do, what device you're going to do a paper design of, or who you would like to interview. If you need help in identifying any of these folks, please let me know and I can provide some suggestions. Room 36 on the second column of the sign-up list is option for a room 36 pass, and these are for people who are working on team projects or individuals who are working on projects to come up with a paper design. So I'd like to have everybody, you know, sign in yes or no, because I need to transfer some funds to make this happen, and it'd be good to have an accurate count. So please, maybe I'll just pass this around so I can get all the information. And I hope to do that tomorrow because I know some students want to get started in there. Upcoming events, a week from tomorrow is the Product Realization Network Mentor-Mentee Lunch, and now there's a room for that. It's in Y2E2 room 299, and one of the teams has decided to present their project to mentors, and hopefully the mentors will be able to give them some advice on parts of their project. So if there's any other teams that want to do that, please let me know, and I'll talk to Professor Reese about that. The ACM Tech Talk is also on Friday the 4th. Alan Brightman, as I mentioned, was the head guy at Apple working on making Apple computers accessible. So he has over 25 years of working on making things accessible. So that'll be pretty interesting. So it's in Gates, and it's actually a two-hour event, but there's three presentations going on, so it's hard for me to, even though the Alan Brightman's talk was listed first, I'm not sure if that's the correct order. So, but that ought to be very interesting. I'll be there. Fred had a question last time on how much these Braille notes go for. I looked that up today, and the 16-cell version, that's 16 Braille cells on the bottom here, go for $4,600, and the 32-cell goes for $6,400. So, you know, given that, you know, you can buy a netbook for $400, why do you think these are so expensive? Small market, that's right. Parts are expensive. These are piezoelectric elements here that raise the dots. Those are expensive. And actually, I just saw an article today from SRI that SRI is working on a new device for blind people to read, which is a follow-on on the Opticon. Now, this device presents Braille cells, but the Opticon had a little camera that you moved along a printed page, and it would see the letters underneath it, and it would vibrate the parts of the letter that it saw. So you get a vibral tactile A on your finger if it went over an A. And a lot of people had used this to read, and you don't have to know Braille to use it. And it was actually invented here at Stanford by Professor Linville, who's daughter was blind. And if you go over to one of the buildings here, there's an auditorium named after Professor Linville. So he started a company called Telesensory Systems. So, and there was another article I just saw today that I'll send to everybody that's about use of haptic devices in rehabilitation. I haven't had a chance to read that, but it just shows you that a lot of this technology is new, is being worked on, and is addressing the needs of people with disabilities. Okay. I just want to come back to this letter of recommendation stuff, and the whole point here is to develop and cultivate relationships with professors, so when it comes time to have them write you a letter of recommendation, they'll feel comfortable in doing that. So that's the whole point of this. And notice one of the things that these letters of recommendation have you fill out is communication skills, and I'll be talking about that really soon. One more issue here is next Tuesday is the Wool Garage Tour, and I'd like to have everybody who plans on going, whether by bike or whatever, to sign this because I need to get a count. And also on under here are maps and also sign-ups for people who have cars that can take other people and people that need rides. So some of these are from Tuesday, and others, if you can take some people, fill it out. If you need a ride, find somebody that can give you a ride. So I'll pass this around as well. And I think we can accommodate everybody, so the maximum is 50. But that'll be a lot of fun. Everybody looking forward to that? Who's planning on going? Just show of hands. It's gonna be pretty awesome. Okay. So I have a question. Where will you be in 5 years? Can anybody tell me, student, tell me where they're going to be in 5 years? Where are you going to be? Still here. Okay. That's easy. Okay. Besides being at Stanford and still going to school, does anybody know where they're going to be in 5 years? How about 2 years? How about next year if you're a senior? It's scary, isn't it? I bet it is. So what are you going to take away from your university experience? Well, there's a lot of skills that you're learning now that are really important that are probably going to be less important, as you get a job. And, certainly you all probably excelled at learning and knowledge retention and test taking and, spitting back the stuff that you've learned. But those things will be relatively less important later on in life. And your grades are really important. Right now, getting a degree is important. Going to Stanford is meaningful, right now. And maybe for getting your first job, it's going to be very important. But, after you're in the job market, people, don't care, I don't think anybody has asked me, after I graduated, well, what was your grade point, And if you ask, I don't think any professor has gotten that question either. And even what kind of degree you have is becomes less important. So, what is important is, what experience you take, if you have the ability to think critically about things, and most importantly, communication skills are important. I'm going to make a case for that. So my plan when I was going to school is I was have an undergraduate degree in electrical engineering and a master's in biomedical engineering. And I thought, being an engineer, things like public speaking and writing reports and writing in general didn't seem very important to me. I wanted to focus on my engineering skills, but I didn't realize that communication skills are probably the most important thing an engineer can have. So what situations can you think of where good communication skills could be beneficial? I have a list. First of all, you want to show others how smart you are. How else are you going to do that? Dressing nicely and your good looks will only take you so far, right? You need to have something beyond that. So the communication skills are important. Excuse me?
Just a side note.
other than being an entertainer, you know. Okay. Too late. When your class requires you to take part in discussions, present your team's project, and write project reports. Who's taking a class like that? Better all be raising your hand, because that's what we're going to be doing here. When you want to convince your professor that you deserve an A or a better grade than you're getting. So it's important to express yourself well when you're doing that. When you want your advisor to write a good recommendation for you, that's always important. When you're interviewing for your first job or competing for a promotion, again, important. When you are teaching a course or presenting your research or presenting your project or presenting a proposal for research, when you're asking for money, it's good to have good communication skills. When you appear on 60 Minutes, how many have been on 60 Minutes? Okay, I'm the only one. All right. I had my 43 seconds of fame on 60 Minutes with Leslie Stahl. When you're giving Stanford's commencement address, okay, it may seem unlikely. Shh. Okay. All right, I'll get a different picture next time. When you're giving your Nobel Prize acceptance speech, right? When you're participating in a presidential debate, okay? When you're giving a State of the Union address, these are all places where good communication skills are important. The point is that you don't really know what opportunities are going to be coming your way, and you don't know where you're going to end up. If you would have asked me, you know, when I was in school, if I was going to be ending up teaching a class at Stanford, I would say no way, that's impossible. But you never know what will happen. So you have to plan for these things. And communication skills are the one thing that you can carry from job to job that will help you no matter what you do. So please give it the attention it deserves. Comments on this? Yes, you have to justify your job in a lot of cases. Yes? That's right. Yeah, research itself, you have to write. You go to conferences and present your work, and people judge you on that. People will give you money based upon how well you write your grant proposal or not give you money. So it's very important, and it's a good skill to have. So next Thursday, we're going to be having a webinar from my colleague Dick Steele, who's up in Spokane, and he's going to be talking about the Lingraphica. This is a device that serves people with aphasia. These folks do not have the ability to read or speak or understand speech. And in fact, maybe Congresswoman Giffords might have a brain injury that results in aphasic type conditions. So she might be a user of a device like this. So we have good web access, and I'm crossing my fingers it'll work this year. So that'll be fun. Next Tuesday we have a tour of Will Garage, and the sign-up sheets are going around, so please fill those out. And here's a map of how to get there. So here's University Avenue, and Stanford is over here. So the best way to go while driving is to go out to Alma and rather than go on University, go on Lytton or Everett to Middlefield, go up Middlefield to Willow, make a left on Willow, and it'll be on the left side over here. So it's in very close biking distance. There's parking in the front and back. It's a one-story brick building, and we'll meet in the lobby at 4:30. That's that. So, but today, Today we have Bill Geary, and I'm going to do my best to embarrass him by telling everybody a little bit about him. Bill Geary has worked as an electrical engineer at the Rehab Engineering Center of the Smith-Cadwell Eye Research Institute in San Francisco for over 35 years, where he designs vocational assistive devices, including measuring instruments and devices relating to job modification. Bill was born in Reno in 1947 and has been totally blind since a very early age. His interest in devices for the blind goes back to his early childhood. His father, who was also blind, kindled his passions for radio and early recording machines. His father had a collection of the Braille Technical Press, which dates back to 1950, and it became an integral part of Bill's education. Was that in Braille?
Yes.
Okay. With encouragement of Robert Gunderson, the editor of the magazine, the Technical File, a publication of technical information for the blind, for blind enthusiasts, was born and continues to be supported by Smith-Cadwell. Bill got his amateur radio license in 1960 as a teenager and now holds an extra class license. And Bill earned a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering from Cal State Polytechnic College in San Luis Obispo in 1971. And among his many activities and accomplishments include being the founder and editor of the Smith-Cadwell Technical File, which is an international magazine for the blind. He's been a lecturer at state rehab technical seminars. He's been an exhibitor at annual ResNet conferences, which I can attest to because I've been there, and at the Lawrence Hall of Science career program. He's been a field instructor for the Sensory Aids Foundation. He's been a participant on the Handicap Science panel at the AAAS annual conference. He's been an expert witness before the California State Attorney General's Commission on Disability. He has been a teacher of classes on electricity and magnetism at the Lawton Elementary School in San Francisco. He's been a panelist at the Arizona Governor's Committee on Employment of the Blind. He's been an instructor of Exploring the Mysteries of Creativity workshop, sponsored by the San Francisco Unified School District, their Center for Advancement and Renewal of Educators. He's a member of the National Institute of Disability and Rehabilitation Research and their Task Force on Accessibility Guidelines for Electronic Equipment. He's been a member of the Advisory Panel Committee for Computer and Customer Service Training Program of the Lions Blind Center in Oakland. And Bill is a member of many professional organizations, including the IEEE, ResNet, the AAAS, and the National Foundation for the Blind. And Bill's other interests include piano restoration and collecting cylinder and other old recordings. And he lives in San Francisco with his wife. So I'd like to welcome Bill to Stanford. Okay, let me give you the microphone. Put this in your pocket.
I'm supposed to do that.
I gave you my cell phone instead.
I was about to answer that. Yeah.
Sorry.
But that's all right, Deb.
Okay.
You give it away. Oh, I didn't know this was working. Oh, okay. I get to talk like this. This is how a lot of kids at the blind school would do this. They'd talk like that. All right. Okay. Hello. Testing. Myself. Yeah. All right. That sounded like a lot of stuff. You know, it's when you've been working for 39 years in the same lab, it's not so big a deal. So, well, welcome everybody. The title of this talk is that engineering has a common root with ingenious, with ingenuity, ingenium, ingegnare. I know, it's enough to make you sneeze, I'll tell you that. And that means that it's First of all, it's degree blind, to tell you the truth, because most of the things on this table were designed by non-degreed persons, and in fact, all, because I'm involved in that, of these items were designed without being a certified rehabilitation engineer. And the point is that the ingenuity has to be coupled with some background. It's true, like the fellow said, you have to be able to explain yourself. One thing you cannot do is design something without homework to see what's been done already. That's fatal, because you end up with the silliest of projects, like a color machine to help you walk. That was my favorite. It's like as if... Actually, there was one worse. There was a guy, we called him... the last name was Fields. We called him Magnetic Fields. He was convinced that since all the magnetic fields around us are unique from point to point, you just teach a blind person to recognize that and have magnetometers, or more than one, and walk around with that, and that would help you with mobility. So don't do that. And the second sentence of this talk is that if you come up with a good and true definition of the problem, then that it suggests the solutions. And the ingenuity is simply to take life's tinker toys and put them together and execute, create a solution to a problem. He gave you tons of handouts. One of them is sort of my attempt to escort somebody into being disabled. And that's the support services one. What I always say is, it seems to be a tragedy. I mean, I was blind at 10 months age, and my father was blind at 6 months of age. So we didn't dwell over the tragedy. But people who become disabled for many reasons, because we're about to, most of us live to be 90, see the tragedies befall them of, oh no, I shake too badly and I can't make tea anymore. So there is tragedy, but one can avoid it, because adaptation, as I always describe, is to expand the familiar. I don't go to restaurants anymore because I can't tell where the waiter puts down the glass of milk or the coffee. Sure you can, because you have to gracefully be graceful, but learn grace to look for it. And look for it close to the table with either the hand like this or your hand like this, so that you won't knock things over. You'll bend. And you'll find it. You don't care where you put it down, you'll find it. There was a neat book in the 50s by a blind woman who married a deaf-blind man, and it was called Handbook for the Blind. And it was subject to great ridicule, because people, especially blind people, said, what do we need that for? Well, here's something. She says, when you have a baby or when you approach a baby, don't reach for the baby. Reach for the baby with your hands, with your fingers pointing away from him. Otherwise, you'll poke him in the eye maybe, or you'll frighten him with your grimy claws. So keep folded like that. She said, when you're in an unknown restroom, look for the towels first. Because if you do that, you won't have to leave your wrist prints on the walls trying to find the towel dispenser without getting the walls, spotting the walls and they're wet and all that. And when you're dancing with a deafblind person, well, I knew a deafblind, he was fairly, I mean, you'd call him profoundly deaf, I think, because you had to really yell directly into his ear if he didn't have his hearing aids on. And anyway, she said, go to places with a good beat and a flexible floor. It's a concrete floor. You can't feel the beat through your feet. They can ridicule all they want. They're wrong. Because that's engineering. That's engineering as good as it gets. And so, on this table are some relics, but some fairly profound developments that led to good solutions. And what a good engineer does is to build on what has already existed. There used to be a, I guess you'd call it a credo or a mission statement of National Institute on Rehabilitation and Disability and Rehabilitation Research. To neat, cool. Oh, well, it's it didn't like my speech. It's retracting. Oh no.
Sorry.
That's all right. It's I'm glad to see it going. Well, anyway, so where was it? Oh, building on stuff. You build on what's been done before. Obviously, of course, that's what you do. You don't build a transistor radio until somebody has designed a couple of pieces, three pieces of differently doped a semiconductor to make a transistor, right? And you don't build a radio before somebody has actually messed around with amplifiers. So it makes sense to build on what's there. Counselor teachers know that. And so they come up with stuff for the home. And that's the projector of offending nature going there? Oh, I see. Yeah, I don't blame it again. That's my speech really warms them up. It's done that all my life. I quit baking, she says, because I can't measure the ingredients without spilling them. I can't. It's just awful. I get it all over the place. So a counselor teacher walks in and says, well, you got to not use plastic ones, but here are some metal ones, and I've modified them. You take the metal ones, and you bend them in a vise, and you make ladles out of them. So if you want a half teaspoon of whatever was in this spice here, you go straight down. You swizzle around in that stuff so that it's full. You bring it straight up, greet it with your thumb, and you haven't spilled anything, and it's trapped. You bring it to where you want the ingredient and empty the ladle. I could pass these things around. Is that what you'd like, David? Or okay, here's a bottle with a spoon in it. These are standard. You don't need to see these. They're just standard. Okay, it's cool. Okay, here's an example of what had to be tried first in order to get as far as the ways I'm going to show you. But here we go. Here's a very nice, it's a 2-foot rule, I guess, because a yard is too long for blind people. No. But So it's neat. The stores like the Lighthouse have quit carrying it because they deem it obsolete. Well, it's something. I mean, but if you look at it, the resolution is not so easy to make sense of. Here's another generation. And this has, not only does it have numbers, it only goes to 11 and the rest you fall off the earth, you see. Okay, no, I'm just kidding. So below each number is a half dome of a marking here that allows you to put your fingernail next to it. So these are fingernail gradations, and they they lead to an edge when at the very edge, not only are they at 1/8 inch, but they are 1/16 inch markings. So with a working fingernail, you can get much higher resolution than the earlier units. Ha! Ah, but what comes next? There was a guy in 1950 who worked at the American Foundation for the Blind, and he came up with absolutely tons of stuff that you'll see in catalogs today. This has 16 threads per inch. It's just a piece of bolt, that's all. Then he flattened this area so that you can lie it down on a thing. But it has 16 threads per inch and a marking on the nut. And when you turn the nut, each full turn is a 1/16 of an inch. Each half turn is a 1/32. Each quarter turn is a 1/64 of an inch. And carpenters use a long version of this to this day, blind carpenters. And by George, it's tops. I use it to mark all the kinds of projects that we build over at Smith Kettlewell. Those are standard. Oh, here's another attempt. You know, how does a blind person use a micrometer? Well, a micrometer is a very precision instrument. It goes as far as an inch, this one does, and it's 40 turns for one inch. And sighted folks look at a part here called the thimble, which has very finely ascribed lines in it. Well, Sterrett made a version for blind people where they just deepened the grooves of this micrometer. Now, the only problem is a major consumer of micrometers are piano tuners, and they want a micrometer to measure the diameter of music wire and the various pins and so forth of stuff like that. So blind piano tuners step in and they say, wait a minute, I forgot to finish the thought. This micrometer has something in the way of your fingernail, so you can't use it at small dimensions. It's from here on out, it's useless. All this here, see? So for piano tuners, this won't work. Now you can go pass this out. But so blind folks, I'll talk this one up. For blind piano tuners, use a thing made by the Sterrett Company called a go-no-go gauge. You'll hear that term a lot. Go-no-go meaning it either does something or it doesn't. This is a 0.50 go-no-go gauge. It has slots in it that allow a wire to pass when you get to the slot that's wide enough for it. So that's size 12, 13, 14, 15. It goes halfway into 15, so you know that this wire is a 14 and a half. Now, I've forgotten what the diameter of size 14 and a half is, but that's a quick go-no-go gauge. a guy named Bill Gary lost his job once at Smith Kettlewell because the grant ran out. So they sent me to Paris, France. They didn't say keep going, so I came back home. But anyway, they sent me to Paris, France. And they said, there's a guy over there who wants to know about our fancy machine. I'll get to that machine, the Smith Kettlewell machine. And you're the expert on it, so you're going to France. I said, well, okay, I'm out of work. What the heck? And I met a blind, non-degreed, very Renaissance man, engineer over there who had a machine shop. And he made a micrometer that suggested the right solution. It was complicated. It was very much more complicated than this. But I came back and I talked to our machinist. We got our grant back, by the way. I talked to our machinist and we came up with this design. This has an expanded scale. It also has the feature that this bar is exactly one graduation in width. So you can split a 1,000th mark, or you can estimate 1/4 of that, or like so. So it has other features. But anyway, piano tuners who have those like them. I think there are 3 out there in existence, which is another problem. That's called technology transfer. That's a problem. So you can see the evolution involved in this, because it goes from you've got hardware stores that you can shoot from. You can figure things out by going to hardware stores. You can look in those catalogs, and there are items that are for sale that are pretty good. The catalogs like the one from International Lighthouse in New York are sifted through, so they're likely not to sell you a talking clock that you can't set the alarm. Whereas in these catalogs, you might very well get a talking clock that will tell you the time just fine, but if the alarm is set for midnight and you can't change it, that's too bad for you. So a responsible store, such as the Peninsula Center down here and so forth, is supposed to check for that, so that they won't you won't get trapped. So you've got catalogs, you've got hardware stores, and then if all else fails, you call places like Sensory Access Foundation, or last ditch effort, you call Smith Kettlewell, and we'll drum up a solution, which could be very easy. And I'll show you some of those ready-made solutions. But you would call that the specialized R&D, which our micrometer, for example, is one of those specialized. And I made a lot of gauges for a blind machinist down in Santa Clara who's passed on. But I love those gauges. They were very sensitive. One of them, you could tell 10 millionths of an inch of movement, and it used it for turning very highly precision round objects on a lathe and so forth. So anyhow, that's the trend. So we've got the hardware stores, we've got catalogs, and we've got speciality of things of that nature. Catalogs, for example, I guess, which one do you have? Do you have LSNS or independent living aids? Okay. Well, that's more specific, I think, to low vision or blindness than the LSNS, which stands for Learning Sight and Sound, and that's out of Chicago. That's a good one. And there are ones that about other disabilities that I actually don't know about. So. Or I'd have ordered them up. You can buy things like, there's a gadget called a Sehwen. If you can't trust yourself pouring coffee, then there is a device that I've drummed one up here, cobbed one up, as you might say, which is a set of prongs. This device here is a general continuity tester, and I'll show you some of its uses. So the ones that you get from the catalog are a little tiny gadget, and they all have two prongs that stick over the edge of the cup, and one of them's musical, I understand. But also, I'm going to need to amplify stuff because this is a fairly large room. So I'm going to use induction to amplify these various gadgets. So everybody behave yourselves. Okay, it's detecting my finger, see? But if you get to the top of the coffee, okay? So that's the element of a Seihwen. It has the Seihwen, or the continuity tester, has tons of other uses. For example, Sensory AIDS Foundation, now Sensory Access Foundation, called me up one time and said, we need a color identifier. I said, whoa, color is very complicated. Now, what do you need it for? Now, here we go. Here's one of Jerry Kunz's favorite examples of you have to define the problem specific or properly. You have to come up with an actual definition of the problem. He says, because there's a little component called a diode, and it has colored bands on it. It has to go a certain way in a consumer product. I think it was a Citizens Band radio. And he said, so we've got a job all lined up for somebody, but the problem is she needs to orient these parts and these colored bands. And I said, no, but it's a diode. So here's what you do is you take this little railroad track. Again, let me see if I can amplify. So here's a piece of railroad track and a continuity tester. And if I put the diode on here one way, it beeps. If I put it on the other way, it doesn't. So the worker lined a whole track load of these things up and then scooped them off into a tray at the end, and they were all lined up. Now, of course, that job wouldn't exist except that it's because machines load circuit boards with diodes in the right direction. But when I worked there first, I was doing a technical job, and oh, here's a diode to show off. I was testing stuff, and some of the circuits didn't work. And one of the things that I was doing was replacing diodes. And when I replaced them, the supervisor said, "You've got four of these wrong." And I said, "No, I don't." And he said, "Yes, they're wrong." So I said, "Let me show you something." He brought the thing over, and they were marked wrong. So I had them incorrectly, but they were marked backwards. So that's the idea of defined problem. Now, you know, another thing I've heard, and it's correct, the main competition that one of us smart people with our fancy degrees and our big long curriculum vitae and all that, the main competition with us is alternative technique. That's it. Alternative technique is a son of a gun, because they can come up with a solution that's pretty good sometimes. A bent measuring spoon beats the hell out of some kind of gadget that I would be trying to suck up a precise amount that was resettable, so it would suck something up as an else up as a precise amount. So the bent measuring spoons are cheaper and probably work just fine. But this actually does have application. This is a modified battery tester. And what we did is we usually try and think of a standard. What's a standard? What's good? What's bad? What are the conditions in between for a cell? And the cell goes typically from 1 volt is dead to 1.5 volts is very good, is fresh. So we made this machine that this box in here has a calibrated triangle wave that goes like this or like that. It's an electrical thing. It goes from 1 volt to 1.5 volt. And we compare a cell with that triangle wave, and we get, let's see, can I amplify that, or can you hear it? You can hear it okay? Okay. It's playing the tips of this triangle wave. So it's mostly good. If you look at the meter here, it probably says it's mostly good. And put in another one here. These beeps are a little bit longer, so it's mostly good. Let's see what else I got here. I picked some doozy of a. That's a package of Rolaid. That's not even a cell. It's bad. Okay. If it were silent, completely silent, then the battery would be completely fresh from the store. If it's dead, then the tone is on all the time. Now, a teacher of deaf-blind people in Arizona said, we need a hearing aid battery tester. So I built the same thing with a piece of copper on top and a probe that you put a little button cell of any size on the piece of copper and come down on top of it with the button cell. And instead of a tone, it vibrated. So it would go for a battery that's half good, and you'd feel the vibration, and it wouldn't vibrate at all as soon as you touched it to a fresh battery. Now, so in that catalog, you may find a battery tester. It's not this one, and you may find that it says tests hearing aid button cells. What they did is they took battery testers that usually have a button cell test arrangement on them, and they said, why didn't they hook this up to the meter? Everything else makes it beep. Why didn't they hook the button cell? So they do. They hook the button cell tester up to the beeper, little knowing that when you test the cell, well, it ran the beeper. It's bad now, okay? Because the beeper takes so much current that you'd kill the battery by doing the test. That's Heisenberg carried to an extreme. You know, that you influence the test by your or influence the event by your testing, and you sure do. But you know what the competition is? Competition is this. My mother used to do this. You take a cell or your Rolaids. What did I do with the cell? And you connect it to a little motor out of a toy. You can buy these things for $12 at little surplus catalogs. And if you learn the pitch of a good one, let's see. This I can amplify, and it would make me awfully proud to do that because it would prove induction. So, all right. Contact. Whoa. Whoa, Nellie. I need more hands. I'm horribly disabled. I only have two. And but they shake, too. That's another thing about them. Okay. Okay. Now, if the motor goes, then it's dead, maybe. And if it's faster than that, then it's a live one. And that's a worthy piece of competition. Why build this very complicated circuit? Well, not to be outdone, we I wanted to at least build something for wheelchairs, and I got my feet wet in wheelchair mobility. 12% of legally blind people are in wheelchairs now. We don't know what kind, maybe manual, maybe not. But anyway, that's the story. So, and it can be perceived that there's a mobility problem. But there are other problems too. How do you know the condition of your battery? So I took this same circuit and talked to a wheelchair battery guy at Resna, and he said, you want it to start indicating at 11.6 volts? Okay, so go tip, 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 tip at 11.6 volts. And you're really doing damage to the battery at 11.4 volts. So that's when I made it go bap, and it turns out that it's very load sensitive. So when you apply a load and you think the battery's good, it might actually test below 11.4 volts. But if you have to get to Dave Jaffe's class, you just say, oh, the hell with it. Batteries can be replaced. And you run the risk of shortening the battery life from 20 years to 2 years. If you can stay with only using half the capacity of the battery, it might last 20 years. If you insist on running it down, it may last 2 years or less. Well, that's nice to know. So maybe a battery tester is a good idea. We came up with all kinds of, for example, I think our carpenter's level is second to none, and how it works. Let me make it really talk for you. Come on here. And this is this uses a circuit we call it's an outgrowth of a thing called the auditory gimmick, but we call it the gimmick because it's much fancier. But here we go. Okay. Now, you always know which way to go. Okay, but there's a boundary here. It's smooth on one side, and it bloops on the other. So, it's also a sobriety test, so that for blind drivers, they can tell what they're up against before the police stops them, And the commercial level goes, and when you're just right, it goes. Well, now what do I do? And they determine what's a window that's acceptable to them, not to you. Ours has a boundary, which is much better, but it's not commercially available. So, but there you have it. Much of the stuff that we have built hinges on the circuits that were published many years ago. For example, in that Braille Technical Press that was in my finally read bio. What is this circuit, which was published in 1955. And it does all kinds of stuff. For one thing, it's the key to the continuity tester, and the say when. This has a light sensor plugged into it. So you can take this here now our professor, what did he do? He left the room? Is that what he did? Okay. It's hooked up as a light sensor, but that's our lab version of the gimmick, the auditory gimmick, it was called. And it can do all kinds of stuff. It can be used for a blind person soldering. I think I might have dumped my test probe on the floor, yeah. Here's a clothespin with a temperature sensor in it. And if you
clip this onto a component fairly far away from the solder connection. Doesn't much matter. The temperature change, the temperature will change, and the pitch will rise as soon as soldering, what they call alloying of the solder takes place. So, and that same circuit is used for that. What that circuit was published for, and what that board actually accommodates, is to read meters. You know, the old-fashioned meters that had the pointer that behind glass, and that's what that was for. It would change pitch depending on the deflection of the meter. It read the. It actually indicated the voltage drop across the meter. All meters are current meters, but there is a voltage drop that's noticeable, and that little device can detect that. So there's that. Is a solution. I was under surgery last year, and one of the requests, well, it wasn't really a request. They didn't know how to release me for a couple of reasons. Because, for one, they wanted me to measure something here. Some of you recognize it. It's called a lizard flask is the slang term for it. And it has these scales here, see? And this one's for men, I think. And they hang it on the edge of the bed, see? So you do your business and hang it on the edge of the bed. But when I went home, I was to measure. I was to find out how much I had ejected in a given session with that fine lizard flask. So what did I do? I made a version of the Sehwen. Here are a couple of probes here. And so I plug it into the beeping continuity tester. And I'll just pretend that you can hear this. And so I go down in here like so. No, it didn't kill the person next door there like it sounded like. Okay, here we go again. Okay, pay attention. Can everybody hear that? Okay. So when it does that, I pull it out and put my finger here, and the scale is actually quite tactile, so I could read that. And that's how I did that. It was the first thing that came into my mind as a solution. Now what do I do with it? I know. Achte lieber Augustin, Augustin. A young vintage. So, let's see. There's an old joke that I tell. That's enough for you. And that is whenever I would be a smart ass kid, you know, I'd be in the audience during the National Federation of the Blind's arguing over whether or not to pass a resolution or something, and they'd read resolution submission number 13, and they'd go, whereas the so and so and so and so, and then whereas, and they get, you know, and then you'd hear the person reading it turn the page. And I'd go like a talking book does. I'd say, side 7, resolution 13. They never ejected me because they knew I had so much energy that, you know. So here, I'll play a demo tape now of some of the stuff. We've got a very bright guy named Josh Mealy. Dr. Mealy has a degree in acoustics, And one of the things he's interested in is the graphic and scientific presentation to blind people. He's blind from the age of 3 or 4, something like that. And so he decided to study one of the devices that we came up with early, which was, by the way, there's a fine book that's spread out here from here, 10 feet over to here. And one of the items in this book is our nonlinear VCO. Now, we used voltage-controlled oscillators with that that gimmick being passed around as technically a current-controlled oscillator, but it's linear. If you double the current, you don't. It's not musical. Let's say, okay, it doesn't follow the laws of the musical scale. So, if you were to present a waveform to a oscillator and want it to go, okay, a sinusoid, say, the sinusoid would be perceived to be flatter on top than on the bottom. So it needs to have an exponential response. You take the analog of base 10 analog of the voltage going in and present that. And that makes everything look spatial. So we developed an audible oscilloscope. You folks have seen oscilloscopes? Okay. But for those who have not, it's the most important instrument in science. It's got a screen, and it graphically presents electrical events and electrical steady state signals. So that you can look at them and discern the shapes of them and so forth. So anyway, it's very important. So we made an audible oscilloscope using this nonlinear VCO, and that just happens to be on the first panel. Here is the nonlinear VCO. There is the one next to it is the lab gimmick, which is being passed around. But anyway, so a blind man makes those oscilloscopes. You can order one from him, and it's quite good for displaying single valued functions. So, but the thing is, Josh wants to present text material and lecture material and all that in graphic form. So he used a program called MATLAB to design a thing called Smith-Kettlewell Display Tools, and you can actually look those up at WSKI for Smith-Kettlewell Institute .org /SKDTools. But here's his. Here are a couple of graphs for you.
There are three characteristics to these audible graphs. One is we discovered quite early on at Smith-Kettlewell that a linear voltage-controlled oscillator gave a perception of a compression of the Y value at higher pitches than at lower pitches.
I love this announcer.
One wants the delta Y, shall we say, if you double the Y value, you want, let's say, an octave in perceived pitch, no matter where you were in the musical scale. The next thing is that Dr. Mealy has added steps in the pitch, which are divisions along the y-axis. So the parabola has descending steps, which then do not occur across the bottom of the parabola, and then they ascend with these steps in the pitch as the slope gets greater. And the third feature is a tick as an axis is crossed. For example, as the Y-X axis is crossed, there's a tick, and the parabola is placed so that it's the bottom of its bowl is below the x-axis, so you hear a tick in the descending part of the parabola and another such tick in the ascending part as it crosses the x-axis. Then finally, where there's a discontinuity in the hyperbole that are presented here, so that the part of the y-axis that's displayed, which can't be minus infinity or plus infinity, there's a burst of white noise as the y-axis is crossed. So here comes the parabola y equals x squared minus 1, which takes it, as I say, below the x-axis.
Come on, Arthur Murray, here we go. I dance too fast.
First one is left of the y-axis and is below the x-axis. It comes from infinity over on the left and was an asymptote to the x-axis, and it then curves down to become approaching an asymptote of the y-axis. Now, the infinity below the x-axis for this half of the hyperbola is discontinuous. Obviously, no page is infinitely tall, so during this discontinuity, there will be a burst of low-frequency noise representing infinite negative y. So then, as we cross the y-axis, there's a burst of high-frequency noise, which represents the unexhibitable part of the positive y-axis, and then the hyperbola comes down and approaches the x-axis on the right-hand side, on your right, as an asymptote, which it can never reach, so you won't expect the same pitch from the beginning at the left of this end of the right. Obviously, my description of this is so bad that you'll learn more from listening to the curve, which is actually the genius of this whole arrangement.
Does that describe it?
Dr. Josh Mealy, M-I-E-L-E, display tools, Smith Kettlewell display tools, or SKD tools, which can be gotten via www.ski.org/SKD tools. And his email is jam. J-A-M, as in Mike, at ski.org. They are generated in these examples by the MATLAB.
Okay, I told you that. I have to conclude, so I'll do that. It's very hard for me to do, but I'll give it a try. And that is with a, again, restatement. Ingenuity is the point here. But what I have to do and what a degreed engineer has to do, you can cob something together and it may work, but I have to explain in scientific terms why, and the decisions that I made have to be defensible. So that's the major difference between somebody who's an engineer and somebody who is not. But don't forget what I said. everything on that table, besides the stuff that I showed you, with these things were designed by people who did not have those credentials. The measuring spoons didn't, for sure. Here, though, one of the things we're famous for is our... is our talking signs. We came up with the concept in 1979. It's a current product. It's all over the place. There are thousands of these things now scattered about the world, with over 1,000 in San Francisco alone, indicating things, stuff. I mean, you could put a talking signs transmitter on the top of a taxi, and then a blind person would never again crawl into somebody's car who wasn't a taxi. And so the blind person, or a person who is dyslexic, or whatever reading disorder, carries a receiver with a, it's an FM radio essentially, with a clear window and a photodiode in there, and the signs are just infrared signs. They're just they need power. That's true. But here's one of them, and this one has a recording of a Marriott thing that was just on display in Washington D.C. So anyway, it has the characteristics of vision. There's no sign over there. There's a sign. Where is the sign? That's a bad signal. You hear that? It's a crappy signal. So if I move... Okay, so it's somewhere in there. So I move like so. I passed it. See? And at great distances. I mean, if that depends on how many LEDs you want to stack up. There's one more device which is at least good for a joke, and I hate to waste a joke. I just hate it. Where is it? I'm looking for the stud finder. Oh, I put it over here, didn't I? Somewhere over here. Okay. There's a device called a stud finder. See, it doesn't seem to be indicating. There we go. That a boy. It's used for finding the structural members behind walls so that you can hang your grand piano from the wall. And so what you do is you look for a hollow spot here. You put this up here and calibrate it. There's a stud there. There's another thing here. That's probably the stud. These are maybe pipes. There are other pieces of stuff back there that aren't studs. But anyway, that's there's this. This is our audible version of a commercial product. The commercial outfit made one. Yes, they did. But they instead of a column of LEDs with all of them giving a response, they hooked a beeper to the top one. So if you don't have lath and plaster, you'll get just the top light and it'll go deep. It won't give you the dynamic signal that I'm very proud of, dynamic stuff. This selection of posters here, I encourage you to come look at. It's comes from a section on the web that I called Devices Supportive of Research. And when I assembled that, and we created and we put pictures together for that book, I wasn't in it. I discovered I wasn't in it. There are other names in there, but I'm not in it. Why? What arrogance? What arrogance would I have to say that I have not built these things out of the Tinker Toys? I was at a convention of the National Federation of the Blind in 1956. And I didn't understand the words of the president as he spoke at the banquet, but I well remember this absolute enthusiasm that took off. The room caught fire at the end of that talk. I'm an atheist, but I can still deliver this bit. And the part that is fetching is that these were blind people who, before all the hipness or any of the acceptance that we see today, none of that was part of their experience. There were very few job opportunities, although World War II actually opened up a bunch of them. Blind folks became Rosie the Riveter, and there were a lot of them, a lot of us employed in factories of war munitions and so forth. But anyway, so here they were sitting in this room with this constitutional lawyer who formed the National Federation of the Blind, not for, but of. And he said, "You have heard the saying, 'There but for the grace of God go I.' What unspeakable arrogance. As if there were a special grace. The person who says that passes by, it conjures up the impression or the picture of a beggar by the side of the road asking for alms, and the person walking by maybe gives him something, maybe he doesn't. But if he says, 'There but for the grace of God go I,' he presumes some special grace metered to him, withheld from others. With one small change. How about this version? Here within the grace of God go we." And the tables turned over and the glasses broke and the dishes were everywhere, and it was really something. Thank you. I'll take answers. I don't want any questions.
It's past class time, but if you can stick around and want to come up here, I'm sure Bill will show some of these things off to you and take a look at them closer. And I'll see you Tuesday at the World Garage. Thanks so much.
All right.
Please take handouts. Please bring the sign-up sheets back.
I'll get this out of the way of the posters.
Bill, I'd like to meet you.
Hey, who dat?
Frank Engel.
Hey, Frank.
Hi,
howdy.
Frank.
Whoops.
I've just done
something.
Pastor, I would say, recently retired.
Oh, okay.
I'm a biomedical engineer developing
electronic
devices.
Good for you.
And,
okay. You're the kind we're after.
Well, I like to do stuff like this. I'm a lab guy.
Yeah.
To connect almost anything to a smartphone, because a smartphone
that's
is
correct.
A smart thing that
we that's right.
And so one thing that this class could do is develop the standard for interfacing the phone to the thing so that students could do lots of projects.
Yeah.
And, you know, so you can have voice generation menu, and you have an inexpensive device in which the device can be replaced with the next version of it.
All right.
So I'll mention that.
Yeah, if there's, you know, whenever the proposal is a standard, industry will balk. And they've done a fine job up to now. The iPhone and the iPod and the iPad have really broken a mold there. But there was in 1986, a revision of the Rehabilitation Act that said that the government will buy and undercut the bidding process, would just dismiss the bidding process, accessible electronic equipment and computers. And when it, after it didn't work for several years, I met the Compaq guy at Resna. And I didn't even... I didn't even introduce myself. I just sidled up to him and said, why didn't it work? He knew exactly what I was talking about. And he said, because, my boy, he said, your big government, as much as it is only 10% of our business. So we decided, informally, industry decided to ignore you. So you'll be up against that.
This is a perfect time to talk about that, though.
Because yeah.
The economy is bad and people can't get jobs. This is something you can do as a small business.
Yeah, well, yeah, yeah.
You can make something useful.
Yeah, that's right.
People.
In fact, there was a group called Outspoken that made the Macintosh talk. And it was a small business. In fact, it went into the toaster, the flying toasters and stuff, you know, for screensavers.
Right.
Yeah, that was their main business, but to make the Macintosh talk.
With you right next.
Hello.
Hi.
Hiya.
Pleasure to meet you.
Likewise.
The presentation you gave today.
The pleasure is, of course, myself.
Thank you, monsieur. Fred's here with me.
Yeah. Right. Hiya. How are you doing?
Enjoyed your lecture.
Okay.
I learned a new term today.
What's that?
Lizard flask.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, may you not have to use one often, or if you do, enjoy yourself. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Using it when I had my hip surgery.
Oh, yeah. Boy, you bet. Yeah. Hello. Hey, George.
You don't need to shake my hand.
Okay. All right. All of the stuff just gets piled into a box. There's one box that's empty. Oh, I know what. There's one thing I do want to. Oh, give me the rest of my drink down there, the lizard flask. Yeah. No, the other one. The other one, it's still got water in it.
Still drinking.
Yeah, it's still got water in it. The stud...
He did this at a radio convention.
Wah, wah, wah.